All right, well, thank you. So it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm learning a great deal, asking a bunch of naive questions, as I like to do. So I was going to tell you something very empirically motivated, what we might learn by directly imaging black holes with resolutions capable of imaging their event horizons. This is a large project, which I'll tell you more about in the future. It's a 200-strong collaboration, the Event Horizon Telescope collaboration. All honor and glory belongs to the collaboration. All the mistakes are mine. A number of students have worked with me. They, of course, are the brightest elements here. I have a number of postdocs. They're only beginning to redshift. And then I have a number of more senior collaborators who are crossing the horizon as we speak. So what are we really after? We're after understanding the nature and goings-ons of black holes, the high-energy astrophysical phenomena. For this crowd, I'm really going to focus on the physics questions, the deep physics questions we're trying to answer, which are things like, do black holes even exist? That is, are there compact regions in space-time that things fall into and don't come out of? For an appropriate definition of don't come out of. In some sense, I'm an astronomer, so that doesn't mean after the page time, okay? But in a long time. And if they're there, are they well described by general relativity? Do they have all of the features that we've come to expect from the Kerr space-time? Things like an innermost stable circular orbit, ergo region, and even is the space-time itself well described? Can we map out the space-time and see that it's well described by the Kerr metric? There are also astronomical questions. How do they grow? How do they produce the luminosities we see? How do they launch the outflows that drive their impacts on the universe? I'm going to skip past those as much as I can. We'll understand these as much as necessary to get the physics questions today. And as I said at the beginning, we're going to try to find answers to these things using direct imaging. So not making beautiful radio images like this that extend over hundreds of kiloparsecs, but zooming in on the very center. The difficulty with directly imaging black holes is they're compact. So typically, the emission about a black hole will be lensed, magnified, due to the miracle of gravitational lensing, and have a characteristic scale of order 10 gravitational radii. This is independent of the nature of the emission region. So this is for an accretion disk. I'll say more about that later. This is for a jet model. In both cases, you see this silhouetted region associated with the image of the horizon. That's about 10 m across. And that's roughly independent of spin, 10% dependent upon spin. For the black hole at the center of the Milky Way, Sagittarius A star, which we've already heard about today, it's 4 million solar mass black hole. It's 8 kiloparsecs away. This scale is 53 microarc seconds. That's a new angular unit for people who have not heard me talk recently. It turns out that Sag A star is not the biggest black hole, and it's not the closest black hole, but is the closest big black hole. And as a consequence, it is the largest angular cross-section of any black hole in the sky. Next in line is M87, which I'll only briefly touch upon today. That's the supermassive black hole, nearly ultramassive black hole, 6 billion solar masses that lies in the galaxy at the center of the Virgo cluster. After that, there's a whole host of things that are factors of a few to an order of magnitude or a couple order of magnitudes smaller. These are the things we know about. Of course, there are things that we don't know about that could also appear here. There's a new class of ultramassive black holes, 10 billion solar masses or bigger. They can, of course, be further away, and they could be close to this limit. Yeah.
All right, so M87, since it has the same angular diameter as Sagittarius A, does it mean it's much larger?
Yeah. Sagittarius star is 4 million. M87 is 7
4
billion.
Is magnitude more massive than Sag A?
No, it's...
Because the distance is 4 orders of magnitude, roughly.
Yeah. It's 2,000 times more massive. This is not my plot. It should be only 2,000 times further away.
It is okay. About
2,000
times further away.
Good. I don't have to yell at Demetrius. Okay. So in order to put multiple pixels across this, we have to be able to read the writing on a dime on the other side of the planet, or since we're in Canada, watch the hockey game on the moon. Not like they did in the 80s, where you just kind of followed the puck by where everybody was focusing their attention, but actually watch the puck. Okay, so to do that, it's quite difficult because of the diffraction limit. Something like the Hubble Space Telescope despite being an extraordinary instrument, has a diffraction limit that's 2,000 times too large, too low a resolution to do this. Even the next generation sets of telescopes, things like the 30-meter telescope, the overwhelmingly large telescope, probably the best name ever, 200 times too low resolution. There is a method that astronomers have used for some time, though, to access very, very high resolutions. That's interferometry. And there are dedicated instruments like the Very Long Baseline Array. And effectively, what they do is they sample the incoming electric field at the aperture. And then on computers, after the fact, bring it to focus. And in doing so, effectively turn the Earth into a single aperture, a single mirror. So this is a way to make Earth-sized radio telescopes. And this is exactly what the Event Horizon Telescope is. So a little bit about what that is practically. It's a global collaboration. There are 13 partner institutions, of which Perimeter is one. There's more than 40 affiliated institutions. We are spread out now on 5 of the 7 continents and looking to expand into Africa. Surprisingly, despite their long history of radio astronomy excellence, we don't have any Australians on board, but hopefully that will change. Then we could be on all 7 continents. And at Perimeter, we have the Event Horizon Telescope Initiative attempting to build the analysis tools for getting science out of the Event Horizon Telescope.
Once in Antarctica?
Once in the South Pole Telescope.
Okay, that's close.
That counts. Yeah. I was at one point trying to figure out where it was on Google Earth so I could plunk a little thing down for an animation, and I couldn't find its latitude and longitude.
Maybe it
took me a while, and then I sorted it.
Yeah. Is part of Europe, or?
Yes, yeah, we have Pico Valletta. NOIMA will be joining in 2019. Okay, so VHT is not a pie in the sky idea. It exists. For the past more than a decade now, a prototype version of the VHT consisting of 3 stations in Hawaii, Arizona, and California has operated. And even at this stage, the Event Horizon Telescope is a data-rich instrument. What we really measure with an interferometer is the Fourier transform of the intensity map. Okay, so the intensity map is essentially the image that you would normally think about. You Fourier transform it, and every pair of telescopes gives us visibility. That's really just the Fourier transform of the intensity. And so we automatically get a number of quantities associated with these visibilities or these interferometric quantities, various combinations that are insensitive or less sensitive to calibration uncertainties. We can also do this in all 4 Stokes parameters, so we can do this in linear and circular polarization. We can do this at multiple wavelengths. We can do this on timescales, I say in short timescales of hours, but we actually have information down to timescales of seconds, all the way up to as long as the experiment has operated, and at the moment, that's about a decade. And we can do this for more than one target.
Question. Why don't do this at the X-ray so that you can use a smaller telescope that's not...
Mainly because we wanted to do it this century.
Because accretion disks are also emitting in the X-ray, right?
Yeah. With an X-ray interferometer, you could see X-ray binaries and resolve the horizon. That would be an extraordinary thing. But it also is extraordinarily difficult. And there are plans or proposals for space-based X-ray interferometers like Maxim.
Yeah.
They're very challenging. the Event Horizon Telescope is really an extension of techniques that were developed in the radio that are essentially being pushed to their limits and their cost-effective limits now. So it's something that was feasible. Okay. But now we've delayed the punchline, which is everything I just mentioned has been done except for pushing to 345 gigahertz, and the experiments to do that are already planned. So we have a lot of firsts, detections of horizon scale structures of various sorts. I'll say a little bit about that later. But it is a going concern for the past decade. And for the past 2 years, since April 2017, we've begun observations with an array that's a quantum leap above what I just described. It has 8 stations located at 6 sites, I guess 7 sites now, around the globe, including the South Pole Telescope, there's a South Pole, a station in Europe, ALMA in Chile, which turns out to be very important to us, And also a new station, the Greenland Telescope, which is just on the other side of the globe. And in the future, NOIMA, so this is the interferometer in Plateau de Bure in France, will join, and the Kitt Peak Observatory in Arizona. So that's coming along for, I think, next year. And so we have two sets of observations with this entire array. And that means EHT is, I say we're measuring things like Fourier transforms of images, but it really is, at the end of the day, an imaging instrument. Here's a simulated imaging reconstruction where we put in a truth image, take simulated data from this with the kind of array that I just described, and then see how well we can put it back together. Okay, take simulated data and from that invert the Fourier transform and generate the image. And in this, remember that this ring, this scale here, was the lensed image of the horizon. And you can see that clearly is present over here. So it really is an imaging instrument. This is, of course, a simulation.
Are there any priors involved in that reconstruction, or is it just completely?
So this is a non-parametric image inversion.
But no
physics priors. The kinds of priors that go into this are positivity of the intensity.
Okay.
And there's something about smoothness of the image.
Okay. Right, that part's slightly more.
Well, you can get an idea of what the beam size is by how large the...
Yeah.
We actually have many different competing imaging algorithms, and things that everybody doesn't see don't get passed on. Okay, so what are the latest results? In 2017, the observations went wonderfully. That was the first time we had the entire array together, so that was a watershed moment for us. Just a couple weeks ago, we did this again. All things look good with both data sets, but the data from the South Pole arrived in November. We actually do have to physically move the data from the telescopes to individual correlation facilities. We have thousands of disk drives. And it's still true that the highest bandwidth transmission scheme is a 747 filled with hard drives. We will have, as a result of it coming back in November, we don't have all the 2017 data analyzed yet. We will have multiple epochs in the galactic center on Sagittarius A star and M87, more than four, by the time the 2018 observations are analyzed. We've already begun imaging, and we'll begin shortly the process of analyzing AGN data, that stuff other than the things that we can see the horizon for. And we will begin this summer, at some point, doing the imaging and science analysis of those objects for which we can resolve the horizon. But I cannot say anything yet.
What's an epoch?
So it's a short talk. What?
What's an epoch?
What's an epoch? I mean by an epoch, one set of observations.
Okay.
So we observe typically for about 5 days each day. Okay.
Sorry. I guess you're limited by the timing accuracy of the... What is the safety accuracy of how well you can do interferometry? It should be the timing, right?
Well, what do you mean by the timing? We have masers at each site. We do have to have a local oscillator, which is quite good when polled even at a few hundred gigahertz. But we have that.
You can label it with time, the photons that you get.
Well, okay. So once you take the data, so we're measuring the wavefront at this site. We measure the wavefront at that site. Okay, we do that by mixing it down with the local, so it's a heterodyne detector. Then you take that back to a single location and we do a fringe search, which is you cross-correlate these two and you adjust the position and time delays at each site until you see a large correlation peak. Okay, so that's a large computational project, but that takes care of, the timing uncertainty that you're talking about, how well we know what time it is over there relative to the time here. Yeah, we take care of that correlation stage. And in fact, that varies tremendously through the night because we're seeing the phase delays in the atmosphere above each telescope, and that varies by many, many wavelengths, many wave periods throughout the night. So apparently, I'm a theorist, they don't let me touch the telescopes, but apparently you can see weather move in across some of these telescopes because you'll see the phase delays get larger over there, and then they'll get larger here, and then they'll get larger there. It's like ALMA, which actually has 60 dishes, right? So having a good enough local oscillator that you can mix down the signal, that's an important step. And hydrogen masers are good enough and transportable.
Avery?
Yeah.
How good is your astrometry? Can you actually do you know what the center of mass actually is?
You should have come on Monday. We can talk later. So we should be able, everything that we're doing right now has no absolute astrometry in it. Okay? We're not using any phase references. But there are phase references close to Sag A star, close enough to Sag A star, that it looks like it should be feasible to do micro arc second astrometry. And if we see a shadow and everything looks kind of like I'm going to tell you it's going to look, then we can actually follow the mass and do things like look for the Brownian motion. And in about a decade, we could tell what the remnant population is.
So, sorry, you can't say anything publicly yet, but can you say publicly when you will be able to say something publicly?
I've stopped guessing. Okay. So this is, we're in the midst of making images of the non-horizon AGN. Then we're going to do the science analysis. Then the really uncertain part is how long is it going to take to stop arguing? And this is going to start this summer. That's kind of, but anything beyond that's a forecast that, well, it's worth what you pay for. Okay, so instead I'm going to, at this point, kind of, I'm going to go through a number of ways that I think is interesting here, that the Event Horizon Telescope will have something to say about general relativity. And this really breaks up into three categories. The first is generic probes. Okay, and the first of those has to do with event horizons. So here's an example of the proto-EHT data. This is from 2011. Shown on the horizontal axis is something that's proportional to spatial wavelength, or spatial frequency. Okay, so large numbers is high spatial frequencies, low numbers is low spatial frequency. This is sort of like the thing that cosmologists like to plot, except instead of L's of 1,000, we're going up to L's of 3 billion. And then on the vertical axis, this is correlated flux density, or essentially that visibility, that Fourier transform of the intensity. Okay, so as we all remember from quantum mechanics, things with a lot of power at high spatial wavelength are small. Things with very little power at high spatial wavelength are large. And so we have a measurement of a rough size of Sag A star already because we have a lot of power at small spatial frequency and much less power at high spatial frequency. So that puts some sort of size constraint. And this size constraint's already comparable. Remember I said 50 microarc seconds was the magic number for the black hole at the center of the Milky Way. This is 40 microarc seconds. That's actually larger than it really is. It's really a bit smaller than that as a consequence of taking out the interstellar scattering between us and the galactic center, but let's just take that 40. That's not terribly unexpected because the image can have a lot of structure in it, but it's already interesting. And it's interesting because an accreting black hole and an accreting star look rather different. The reason is because in an accreting black hole, stuff falls into the black hole, crosses the horizon, never to be seen again, and any energy it takes with it into the horizon is now added to the black hole. But for a star, when stuff lands on the star, it forms a boundary layer. In the boundary layer, it thermalizes all of its excess kinetic energy, and then that shines. And you actually see a thermal bump on accreting neutron stars associated with this boundary layer emission. Okay, so black hole, stuff falls in and goes away. Stars, stuff lands on the horizon and sticks around. And so if you make some modest assumptions, which I'm happy to argue about, that the system in the galactic center has reached steady state, that seems might be a questionable statement. However, you know, it's only logarithmically questionable. It turns out that high redshift surfaces can reach steady state much faster than you might guess. If you have a notion of energy conservation for test particles, so I can talk about the kinetic energy of stuff accreting on, so every stationary space-time satisfies that. And we don't allow any tooth fairies at the object that suddenly turns accreting material into something else that we don't see, which I'm sure we could cook up, then you can start to constrain, based upon this size, whether or not you could have a thermalized boundary layer like a star at the galactic center. As we turn up the temperature to a point where the outgoing luminosity is equal to the ingoing accretion luminosity, and you get this thermal bump in the infrared, and we know how big it is because we know how bright it is because we know how big it is, and it starts to push well above the already known infrared flux limits.
By star, you mean something that has a black body-like spectrum, right?
Well, it turns out if it has a surface, it will almost certainly have a black body-like spectrum. High redshift surface is a is a perverse version of a pinhole cavity, because only a very narrow set of photons, or only in a very small set of angles, will photons be able to escape. The rest of them will just couple the surface back to itself. So nearly any high redshift surface will look like a black body if it has reached steady state.
So how big the temperature can you? How big of a temperature can you? Temperature can you see of this object?
Well, so that there's. That's an interesting way to put it. What there's a couple a different way that I would think of it is what kind of accretion efficiency accretion efficiency would I need? Okay, so how much energy does the accretion flow have to radiate away before landing on the surface? So this is a related thing. 99.9, 99.8%. Okay, which is way higher than the efficiencies we normally talk about. If you take a guess for what you think the so you can make that statement very clearly or not subject to guesses about accretion rates. But if you do plug in a guess for the accretion rate, this is the thermal bump you would expect from Sagittarius A star. These are all the infrared flux limits. That's a few orders of magnitude. You can make the same argument for M87. It's a little more complicated because M87. Almost certainly has a black hole spin power jet, and then it's a little bit more difficult to connect it up with an accretion rate. But you can do something along those lines, and again, many orders of magnitude discrepant. So in both of these cases, stuff is going in, and we are losing it. Okay. This morning and at lunch, I started to ask, is this enough to justify the dissipation assumptions that all the super radiance axion searches need? And I think the answer is almost, isn't it?
Probably not. I mean, let's say it has a very high heat capacity object in the middle. So you just keep on adding energy, but it's very, very hard to heat it up. And it wouldn't show up in your things, but it could still allow stuff to...
That's a great idea. What if we replaced it with something that had a crazy... Because people who talk about gravistars say, you don't understand it. The heat capacity can be infinity. Well, Bob Laughlin and Roger Chaplin, they made the grievous error of providing a model in which you could calculate the heat capacity. And so we did. And it's true, it takes a long time to heat up. But if it takes a long time to heat up, it takes a long time to cool down. And if you thought that Sag A star wasn't just accreting at 10 to the minus 8 solar masses per year like it is right now for its entire life, but in fact had to accrete a substantial fraction of its mass over its life, its accretion rate has to be 4 orders of magnitude higher on average, then we should still see it glowing today. And you can play the same game for a handful of X-ray binaries, and you can rule out, in their case, they have one parameter, a scale length below which gravity changes. They think of gravity as being an effective theory, which makes sense, because Bob Laughlin's a condensed matter guy. But then the scale length we pushed all the way down to the Planck length. But you know, that's a model. You give us a different model, then we can talk about it. So maybe, but it's interesting. Okay, a second kind of generic statement is based on the photon ring or the instability of the photon orbit. So I drew a little picture up here of the black hole, the photon orbit in blue, and rays that are photons that are moving inward at the photon orbit eventually are captured by the black hole. Photons that are moving outward escape, and photons on the photon orbit are unstable. And this is a purely gravitational feature. It doesn't depend upon what's doing the emitting. It doesn't depend on the astrophysics. And it leads to a pileup of photons at the projected radius of the photon orbit. So here's a simulation by Dimitrios Saltis and company, which shows one of their jet disk models. And you can see very, very clearly this pileup of photons. So the idea here is, can we measure the structure of this photon orbit, or this what they called the photon ring? And they developed some tools to perhaps do that. In practice, the galactic center is behind a whole lot of gas in the interstellar medium, which scatter broadens the image. And so we tried this as well, but we did it with a simulation where we allowed scatter broadening to smear the image a bit. You can still find the ridge of the photon ring out here, the ridge line, and you can fit that with a circular model, and we did that, and you can get some estimate for how large it is, and therefore how large your photon orbit is. But one thing that I think is also interesting here is some people in Portugal, I think Hidério and Pedro Cunha was visiting perimeter for a little while, shows images of what happens when they add scalar hair. Now it's extraordinary degrees of scalar hair. In some cases, they look like something out of Star Wars. Okay, so if we see something that looks like a circle, I think we can already start to eliminate a bunch of these. If we see something with roughly the right size, we can eliminate that one. So that means that there's, you know, maybe some traction. The real question is how much.
Do you have enough? I guess for this, you need some light source behind somewhere around there.
In this simulation, we have an accretion flow around the black hole that is consistent with what we think is in Sagittarius star and consistent with the previous data. Yeah. I'll say more about that in a couple minutes. One way that I think that this might be, ignoring Nabooian starfighters might be more interesting is as a comparison with all the other methods for determining the angular size of the shadow. So this angular size depends primarily upon the mass and the distance to the galactic center. We have ways of measuring the distance, things like maser measurements of nearby star-forming regions. We have ways of measuring distance and mass, things like the S stars, the orbiting mass of stars about the galactic center, structure of the stellar nuclear stellar cluster, and the EHT size measurement of the shadow would put a band on this plot, and they all have to cross at one place. So one, we could improve our mass estimate, but they all have to cross in one place. And so that evokes, in my mind, the binary pulsar tests, where you have many ways, many relativistic effects that constrain the mass of each pulsar, and they had all better cross at one spot. Now here's this wonderful plot from Michael Kramer that shows, in fact, that's exactly what happens. And so I look at this as a 10%-ish test of whether or not supermassive black holes satisfy general relativity at all.
Black hole spin, does it affect?
Yeah.
It does. The width of this line is completely dominated by black hole spin. We said we don't know what it is. It could be anything. That sets the width of the line. Once you measure it, we can make that line 1% thick.
Can that be the way to measure it also?
Yeah. Give me a couple of minutes and we'll get there. So EHT also provides a number of commensal opportunities. One thing that we've already heard you'd like to find is a pulsar black hole binary. I think that's, for many people, a holy grail. And the galactic center is a big black hole. There's supposed to be a lot of compact remnants around it. Surely there's a pulsar. But pulsar searches in the galactic center have come up empty time and time again. And that's because there are two things that modify pulse signals. So the first is dispersion. Anyone who's heard about fast radio bursts knows more about dispersion now than they ever thought they would. But the thing that is more complicated is scattering. You can fix dispersion, but you can't fix scattering. Scattering is just a time delay for those photons that went off this way scattered back to us. Okay. And if you look at the scattering, it gets better as you go towards, or gets less significant as you go towards shorter wavelengths, higher frequencies. If you look at the galactic center, what are the scattering time delays at 1.4 gigahertz and at 10 gigahertz? They're actually at 1.4 gigahertz, where people do quite a few of the pulsar searches, they can be many, many seconds. Okay, this jump here is at the galactic center. So this is distance from us. We go to the galactic center, and there we have this giant jump. So this explains, or at least has been used to explain, why we don't see gobs and gobs of pulsars. It's because they're all scatter broadened. They're there, they just don't pulse. But as we go to higher frequencies, in this case only 10 gigahertz, that drops that by an order of magnitude. Going up considerably higher would drop it considerably more. The reason why you don't go higher typically is that the pulsar spectrum falls like a rock. And so it gets increasingly hard to detect them. Okay. So here's an artist's rendition of ALMA, this 60-some-odd dish telescope in Atacama, Chile. Absolutely extraordinary device, incredibly sensitive. Each one of these dishes alone, I think they're all 12-meter dishes, are sensitive. But if you could add them all together and make effectively one large dish, then you can start doing pulsar searches in the galactic center. And this is actually what the EHT does to ALMA. It phased ALMA into one aperture that we can use while we're watching the galactic center to try to find pulsars. Okay. So what would happen if you found one in a year? So this is work by Dimitrios Saltis, Norbert Wex, and Michael Kremer. You could measure the spin and a quadrupole moment if it was in a convenient orbit. It's relatively close, not unreasonably so. There's a very clear residual pattern that differentiates this from everything else. And ultimately, you could go back to this kind of picture that I was drawing before, except now it's black hole spin, quadrupole moment, and you can put a limit from just the shape of the, or the size of the EHT shadow, the S stars, and with the pulsar measurement, and measure this very carefully. So this would be a wonderful thing if it happens.
You need the periods of less than a year.
Yeah. These are very close pulsars.
Yeah.
Closer than the magnetar and not magnetars.
Sorry, how's the quadrupole moment measured? Through precession?
Yeah, that's right. So I mean, of course, the pulsar lets you do all these exquisite timing measurements, which allow you to very carefully nail down your orbit. Okay, so now moving from sort of generic things, and I'm not sure if pulsars count as generic, but at least they're very well understood, to now let's start digging in the astrophysical dirt.
Sorry, Avery, on the back. So does the determination of the spin, how... Here you assume the spin is 0.6. What happens if it's, how does the uncertainty work as you make the spin smaller? Because for the Sagittarius, it's going to be much smaller, presumably, right? It's going to be 0.2. At least this is what you showed on Monday.
I'll show that again. Okay. If you look closely, it doesn't say that's like one sigma. But yeah, okay. So if it's less than 0.2,
How does the uncertainty work? Because that's pretty precise there.
That's a good question. I don't have a good answer for you. We should talk about that later. Okay, so digging in the astrophysical dirt, actually trying to model the accretion flow. So we know that Sagittarius A star is not sitting all by itself. It's at the center of a large cloud of X-ray emitting gas. Okay, so there's an embarrassment of riches, it is bright. As far as a supermassive black hole goes, it's pretty dismal. But as a radio source goes, it's very clearly one of the brightest radio sources there. So something's powering that, and the amount of accretion available to it is more than enough. And there are a number of pieces of prior information we already have. Here's a movie of those S stars, those massive stars that are orbiting the galactic center on timescales. The S2 gets around in a timescale of 10 years. Okay, that's already been seen to make a complete orbit. We have information about its spectrum. We have information about its polarization properties, which say something about the magnetic field structure and the plasma density between us and the galactic center. And we have some theoretical ideas about how low luminosity or radiatively inefficient accretion flows should appear. Okay? Accretion flows that have lots of gas but can't seem to turn it into light. They should be big, fluffy, thick, nearly virialized disks that emit in the synchrotron. And when you make images of models like those, they look like this thing that I keep showing you. The features of this first are this lensing ring, this photon ring that I already discussed. But it's an orbiting thick disk, so you should think orbiting donut, and the side that comes towards us is bright, and the side that goes away from us is dim, just because of Doppler beaming and the Doppler shift. Okay, so you can imagine generating a set of these models which are consistent with all of our prior information, but differ only in the magnitude and orientation of the black hole spin. And you might wonder at first why that makes a big difference. After all, here's a picture of the photon ring at spin zero all the way up. I'm sorry, this is inclination. I chose the wrong picture. At spin zero all the way up to spin one, it's hardly different. It only changes by about 10%. It looks very similar to this. It ends up being very nearly edge-on. So this is about the shadow of a spin zero black hole, because we're looking down the axis. This is about the shadow, this is an edge-on shadow of a spin one black hole. Why is it the EHT can say anything about this? And it's because we're not fixing the accretion flow. We're fixing the observed properties of the accretion flow. So here's a low spin model that looks very much like the ones I've been showing you. And here's a high spin model. And the high spin model looks much more compact because it's not just the structure of the spacetime that changes, but it's the dynamics of the material on it. And in the high spin model, stuff is rushing at us much higher velocities, the Doppler beaming is much higher, and as a consequence, the emission region has to be more compact to be consistent with the same total intensity.
Does it matter if you have a thin disk or a thick disk? Does the picture change?
I'll show a picture of thick and thin disks. It does, yes. Yes.
And this is assuming now that the spin is aligned with the rotation of the accretion?
In this, yes, in all of these cases, the spin we're assuming is aligned with the accretion.
Where do we know the angle between the spin and the line of sight? Is it actually close to a John?
We don't have a lot of independent measurements, but we've made a measurement with this set of models. I'll show you in a minute. Okay, so with the proto-EHD, here's 7 years of data, starting back in 2007, going all the way to 2013. The details of what the data are aren't terribly important, except to say that this was taken early, this was taken later. An interesting thing about this is that when we fit each night or each set of nights independently, we get consistent answers. That means that over this entire 6 year period, the structure of Sagittarius Star didn't appear to change, despite the fact that over timescales of tens of minutes, its accretion flow can completely reconfigure itself. Okay? A second thing is that this structure is initially essentially predicted by this data up here. We wrote a paper before all the new data was acquired or constructed. And based on that, we had an idea of what kind of models we should be looking for. And so postdictions, you know, fitting data is one thing, but predictions is something altogether different. The idea that we were able to take this data and make a claim on what the image should look like, and then that turned out to be justified or to be confirmed by the later data, which is fundamentally different, a different sort, I think is an interesting thing. And the kinds of models that we construct from this, let's see now, do I have, oh. Let me jump to, I thought I had a picture in here, but I guess I may have taken it out. Here we go, we'll go to this one. After taking the types of models or the types of fits that we have in there, we can constrain the black hole spin magnitude, the inclination, and each one of these is a different position angle, but I really just want to focus on the central panel. That shows the spin magnitude against the inclination for the best fit models. And the important thing is all the blue, the dark blue. So there's an awful lot of regions here that are already excluded, are ruled out at high significance. These are the 1, 2, and 3 sigma contours. You know, this is, at 1 sigma, still a half. Okay. The image family associated with the 1 sigma contour, if we just take points around this 1 sigma contour in each direction parameter space, is shown here. They all differ. It's hard for me to tell them apart. And we can already exclude a number of phenomenological models, models that aren't based on physical inputs, assuming something about an accretion flow and gravitational lensing, but Gaussian blobs and extended Gaussian blobs and the like. So that means, quite interesting, you know, a comparison of this thing with this, that somehow we're seeing the crescent structure already. And now let me go back.
Right. You're saying that you're fitting some general model and seeing those, or you're fitting a point?
Yeah, we're fitting a model that had those two pictures I showed you a moment ago as elements. Okay, there's a whole and a whole host of things in between. So this and that, and a whole host of additional things at different inclinations, different spins, and can be oriented anyhow they want on the sky. And that was the set it chose.
Okay.
Do you have a non-physics based image to reconstruction, or is that not available to
be? You can't with the data that we were fitting. There's too little. We have a handful of spatial frequencies.
Okay.
And so if you try to reconstruct it, you'll just get this big ringing blobby mess.
Okay.
So having a prior, a physics prior, saying it has to be one of these makes a big difference. Interestingly, it actually seems to make sense within the galactic center environment. Here's a reconstruction of the orientation of the spin vector, or equivalently the orbital angular momentum axis. And there are two spots on the sphere as seen from the galactic center. That's because seeing translucent or nearly optically thin disk this way and seeing it that way are very similar. Okay, so that degeneracy is not something that we can break just yet. But one of these is coincident with many other features in the galactic center, one of which is the infrared gas cloud that was accreting and supposed to become tidally disrupted. and didn't a few years ago, and presumably associated with a prior accretion episode. And the second is the clockwise disk of stars that is the presumed source of the accretion flow for Sag A star. So in some sense, we're saying the angular momentum of the disk looks like it's aligned with the angular momentum of the stuff that feeds the disk. So that sounds credible, but it's not really a proof of anything. Another thing that we've done recently is report the first polarization detections on horizon scales. So this is this spatial frequency. Again, larger is higher spatial frequency, smaller is smaller spatial frequency, so higher resolution, lower resolution. And we can detect polarization at each of these spatial frequencies and compare that to what we would expect from different models. Interestingly, the polarization on low spatial frequencies or on large scales is small, and the polarization on high spatial frequencies, so small scales, is large. This is exactly what you expect from the kinds of accretion flow models that we've been putting in, where you take the magnetic field and you stretch it out and shear it out into toroidal features. So we see horizon scale field structures, which translate into horizon scale polarization structures. So it's ordered on just the right scale.
This is from like 100 Gauss field that you were talking about?
10 to 100 Gauss, yeah. So assuming any of that is true, now you can ask the question, how could I start varying not the drama, but vary the stage upon which the drama unfolds? And the first question there is, how sensitive are different elements of my emission to where it's being emitted? So here's a picture, or just a set of images that show what happens if you cut out an inner radius of the emission. We start off by cutting stuff off down at the horizon, and then we allow it the cutoff point to move outward to about 10 gravitational radii. And you can see that a non-trivial amount of the emission is actually already being excluded as soon as we get to the photon orbit. That is, in these kinds of accretion flows, they are not thin disks that extend down to the innermost stable circular orbit and then fall away, never to be seen again, but they actually have material that's supported all the way down to the photon orbit. And there's about a few percent of the emission inside the photon orbit. So with the kinds of signal-to-noise ratios we are already getting, assuming we can handle all of the other astrophysical systematics, we actually do see something that we can statistically significantly understand down near the photon
orbit. How does this vary with spin? I mean, does it matter for the...
Well, with spin, if we're...
Spin disks, it's a big difference.
With it, yeah. It'll be a big difference.
Even here?
It'll be a big difference because the bulk of the emission will move inward.
Even more inward.
Yeah.
Than...
Yeah. Which is what you were seeing in that other picture.
Yeah.
Okay. So we are sensitive to stuff down near the horizon. So to quantify how well we might be able to search for deviations from general relativity, we've turned to deformed black holes or deformed Kerr spacetimes. The idea is to artificially, by adding some additional term that has no physical justification, something to the metric, to the Kerr metric, which makes it either more oblate or more prolate. There are a lot of fine print about this. If you want to ask me all about the fine print, do it later. I agree with you. The no-hair theorem says I'm not allowed to do this in a reasonable way. Okay, so I can deform it arbitrarily, but it's not necessarily a solution to anything. Okay, but nevertheless, upon deforming
could
it...
I have one question. Could this be
Mina.
The existence of a cloud, of superradian cloud, because this is...
That's a wonderful question. That's why I'm showing this to this crowd. Because if you gave me a proper model to plug in that had something to do with physics, then I could show you how well that that's going to... how well we could potentially constrain it. You got it. Yeah.
So is this the best parameterization of deviation? Because for Q...
No. No.
You just have a coefficient, you know, instead of having minus one over there, you could just parameterize it with some fixed number.
So we parameterize it with a number epsilon that's when it's one, for maximally spinning black holes, it's 100% deviation of Q. Is it a unique parameterization? Certainly not. Is it the best parameterization? I'm positive it's not for a variety of different reasons. You know, we're kind of moving on towards different parameterizations. But if there's a better idea, then we would love to hear that too.
Can I follow up?
Yeah.
ask differently, why do you choose NQ as a parameter relation?
So that when we make everything normalized relative to M, so that becomes one, and maximally spinning, so that's one. When epsilon's one, this is 100% change.
I guess I think dimensionally, how does that?
Yeah.
A squared M is dimensions of mass.
A squared M is dimensions of mass squared.
A is
mass cubed.
Oh, A is the G of 1 M. Not G
yeah,
of 1.
Yeah. Yeah. You can see already that there's a non-trivial difference between these sorts of pictures when we get up to epsilon of 0.8 and minus 0.8. Back in 2009, we tried to do this for the first time. This measures that epsilon parameter, the deviation from Kerr. There's our prolate and our oblate as a function of spin. This region is cut out because it leads to disk to innermost stable circular orbits that start to encounter pathologies in the space-time. So we figured that those are eliminated just on theoretical grounds. By construction, we know that that's a crazy thing to do. You can see that the two sigma line, which is here, encompasses the entire parameter space. So it's really just a demonstration that you can start to think about it.
So shouldn't it worse at epsilon equals zero? Because then if you recover Kerr, so as you go close to epsilon equals zero, you should recover the...
I don't worry at all about this. Everything's within two sigma. Most of it's within one sigma.
Okay.
We learned nothing, except that we knew how to set the problem up.
Okay.
this is doing it with the 7 years of data that I showed you from those prior fits. Now there's actually a region that's excluded at two sigma, which is pretty incredible. My student didn't understand why I was so excited by this plot. I said, finally, we're ruling something out. This is how well we should be able to do it with the data collected in 2017.
Thanks.
Assuming that we understand the astrophysical modeling, which might give you pause. Okay, sub-percent level. It's interesting that this is the ISCO. This is the path that the innermost stable circular orbit takes through this. A lot of these sorts of tests that rely on thin disks are really measuring the position of the ISCO. Here we see both dynamics and lensing. We aren't seeing just the ISCO.
So Avery, if you do vary your foreground map, or you change from a C to
foreground map,
ADAP, or if you play with the astrophysics, how much does this mean?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that just yet, but we're working on it.
How much does this depend on assuming the black hole was not charged in the first place, electrically charged? Because before I believe allegation from GR, I probably believed that it was some charge for some reason.
We have not explored charged black holes. I'm not sure I would agree with you.
Yeah, no.
There's a lot of charges out there that will neutralize an electrical charge. That gravitationally significant electrical charge is pretty hard to keep. But that might just be, personal preference.
It would be nice to know if you can move it by 5%.
Yeah.
Sorry, what?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's a good question. So what I'm hearing, if I rephrase that, is start adding knobs to my astrophysics, see how bad that makes things. Start adding knobs to my gravitational physics and see how bad that makes things. That sounds brilliant. Maybe you two read my proposal, because that's what we're doing. And thank you, then. All right. So disk thickness, that's one of the key knobs. Because there are reasons to think maybe you can make virialized thin disks by crushing them with magnetic flux. A lot of simulations show disks that look a little bit thinner. Here's an image of a GRMHD simulation. It looks a little bit thinner, has this kind of tongue of material that's extending across the center. I think the room lights are dark enough, you can see the tongue here. This disk is a little bit too fat. If I make the disk thinner, it looks pretty similar. Okay, so disk height is one really important knob. We've started to allow that to vary. You can also allow the azimuthal velocity profile and the radial velocity profile to vary. And we've started to do that. This is all work led by Hung Yi Fu. We'll stop right there.
Are there degeneracies in the way you determine parameters, like when you were measuring spin before and the inclination? Are there degeneracies with these parameters? Can you pick them around?
Well, you saw one of the key ones with spin and inclination.
Yes, exactly.
That's right.
But what about disk shape and any of these parameters?
So we've started to look into exactly that sort of question. Things like disk height seems to not be terribly degenerate with things. How slow stuff is, or how much it's falling in doesn't seem to be terribly degenerate, but there will be degeneracies. Nevertheless, it looks like it wants to be one of these thin disks, okay, moving at subcapillary and azimuthal velocities. It looks like maybe the galactic center wants to be a magnetically arrested disk. But we'll have to wait and see. I think this will be improved. These are analyses being run by Mansur Karami. A second thing you might worry about is how much does the change in the space-time modify the structure of your accretion flow? And in the simulations or the analysis of the accretion flow, the simulated images did incorporate the modification of the lensing, and they did incorporate the modifications of the dynamics. But they did not incorporate the modification of the radial disk structure. So with Luis Lehner and Boris Georgiev, we started to look at that, and there are some reasons to think that that actually could have a substantial impact. Here's the radial Euler equation written schematically for something that is essentially Bondi accretion. And those of you who have spent time thinking about accretion will recognize the origin of the critical point, this 1 minus Mach number squared, 1 over Mach number squared thing, that's equal to just gravity and pressure balance on the other side. Okay, so normally the flow has to pass smoothly through the critical point so that this derivative remains well defined. A consequence of that is that this critical point value, this 1 minus 1 over Mach number squared, promotes any deviations here. So if I ask how much does moving from general relativity from a Newtonian description modify the structure of my disk, well, it's promoted by this factor here near the critical point. Okay? Or equivalently, if I ask how much does moving from the Kerr spacetime to some non-Kerr spacetime affect things, near the critical point, it can have a rather significant effect. Okay? And so here's a picture of exactly that, produced by Boris, that shows how the infall velocity of the accreting gas, actually the profile changes rather substantially as a consequence from moving from Newtonian to Schwarzschild. Nevertheless, the radial structure of the things that go into the emission, like temperatures and densities, don't seem to change a whole lot. So despite that concern, which is brilliant, I think that in practice, we probably didn't miss a whole lot in not varying the radial structure of the disk, although certainly the height matters, and we haven't explored nearly wide enough a range of potential modifications of general relativity. All right, so in the last 5 minutes, I want to talk about what we might gain not from trying to model the quiescent, in some sense, time average disk structure, but what we might get from modeling violent time variable events. So we know that Sagittarius A star flares about once a day. In the infrared, it becomes an order of magnitude, sometimes two orders of magnitude brighter. This is a movie from the UCLA group that shows the sudden brightening in the infrared. And that extends not just from the infrared, but also extends to the X-rays. So for every X-ray flare, there's an associated infrared flare. And there's also fluctuations in the millimeter. Tantalizingly, although I haven't seen many light curves like this, in the infrared, every now and then, there's something that looks like periods. Okay. So it depends on who you talk to, whether or not somebody believes. If they have the faith, there's something in the accretion flow.
What's the period?
Well, the period's tens of minutes. Okay, this is like 30 minutes. That would be about the period of the innermost stable circular orbit of a Schwarzschild black hole with a mass of 4 million solar masses. What do I think these are? I think that these are solar flares in the centers of disks. That sounds kind of silly. Maybe I'm just very parochial. But these hot, thick accretion flows have a large amount of energy tied up in the ions and very little energy shared with the electrons. That's why they're radiatively inefficient. Anything that can share energy from the ions to the electrons can actually increase the amount of energy that the electrons have by many orders of magnitude before they ever push back and dynamically impact the disk. And these events certainly are happening in the middle of the accretion flow, where turbulence is driving magnetic field back into contact with itself at oblique angles and driving reconnection events. We see these in simulations. We know they must be happening. That's all this is, turbulence in the solar atmosphere driving fields around into contact, driving reconnection. So I really do think that at least a subset of these flares are something like what's being shown in this movie, a sudden brightening associated with a reconnection event catastrophically dumping large amounts of energy into those emitting electrons. The time scales for this in Sagittarius is of order 10 minutes. For M87, it can certainly happen there as well, of order 9, 10 hours. What would those look like? Here's a simulation that we produced longer ago than I want to admit, but it's there. That shows what a localized emission region around a black hole looks like, being viewed from different angles. If you want to know what angle it is, you look up at the Newtonian representation. Okay, as the spot gets pushed more and more behind the black hole, you see it flares, becomes brighter and dimmer. You can also see there's a secondary image. And if you look really close, occasionally, you'll see a tertiary image. Okay, so these are purely lensing features that you can use to map the space-time. What's the idea? What's the idea? Here's a more recent, maybe slightly prettier version of it. The idea is to wait for multiple flares. Flares that happen closer in will produce one set of primaries and secondaries and tertiaries. Flares that are further out will produce a different set. They'll be probing different portions of the space-time. You can also do this in both total intensity and in polarization, and you can even phase reference your polarization to your total intensity. So typically, we're not able to make a nice stable movie like this. We don't know from minute to minute where on the sky it really is. Okay, but we can know where on the sky this thing is relative to that thing. So you can do astrometry and follow the spot around by looking at polarized versus unpolarized emission. Now, in practice, I don't believe the spots are going to be coherent for as many orbits as I showed there. Here's a simulation produced by Paul Tita and Hung Yi Pu of a spot that shears in a Keplerian velocity or a sub-Keplerian infalling velocity field. And you can see that it very quickly gets sheared out into a long spiral structure. Okay, and this is just a density map seen from above in the equatorial plane. What does this look like for in the imaging plane? Here's a simulation performed by Britt Jeter, who put a shearing spot in, and you can see it generates these large arc-like features. This is in comparison to a beautiful GRMHD simulation movie produced by Otaka Shiakawa over there. And I think a lot of these large arms are reminiscent of the streaks we see here. In fact, they're so reminiscent that you might imagine trying to do away with modeling this and just replace it with a bunch of blobs, okay, a non-parametric simulate or reconstruction of the density in physical space. And here's a movie of an attempt to do something sort of, we didn't really attempt to do it, just illustration of what it looks like when you put 10 of them on there. But I think that this starts to look pretty, you know, surprisingly close to that, enough to think that this might be something we could try. In any case, given one of those time variable events, you can reconstruct the position, orientation, and test, consequently, the structure of the space-time fairly accurately, even without generating an image. This is using one of those interferometric observables. Here is an example of many different spots and many different combinations of telescopes. And all that you're supposed to walk away from this with is, one, these things have structure, and two, they can be easily told apart. And in practice, this was from a simulation we did almost a decade ago. Things are way better now. How good, this is how well we think we could identify one of these orbiting features or even some time variable simulation flow, something that is dominated by turbulent structures. Okay, these have error bars on them. That's the SNR that we have now.
So based on this light curve, can you estimate the effective mass of this hotspot compared to the disk mass or something like that?
Well, you wouldn't estimate the mass. You can estimate the luminosity ratio, and you could try to use that to estimate how many electrons are associated with them.
Yeah.
I don't have an answer to that, but it's what are you really asking? You're asking if it's does it make sense? Can you make a spot bright enough that doesn't dominate the disk mass?
Yeah, I'm just curious what fraction of the material is in this?
Okay, yeah. It could be an exceedingly small fraction of the material. The electrons are so under-energized that dumping even a little bit of the ion's energy into them locally changes the luminosity by orders of magnitude. So this is really the tail of the distribution.
So Avery, maybe related to that, how compact does it have to be, or how small does this region have to be for it to give you useful dynamical constraints? I mean, if it's a tenth of the horizon, is it still useful?
Yeah, I think typically we've been putting in things that are considerably larger than a tenth of the horizon. The larger it is, the more complicated it would be in principle to model it, because you'd want to have to model the structure of the spot in maybe more detail. But I think now that we've added shearing, I think we've been putting in things that are a gravitational radius across at 6m could be, that's not the full Wittaff max, that's the one sigma.
Okay.
So have you seen these flares in your radio data? Or is that something? Okay,
he doesn't know. Cannot reveal.
I don't know. I would argue that actually at one point we did see something.
Okay.
But that's a different...
But
let's get a beer. We'll talk about it.
All right.
Not in the new data. I don't know anything about the new data.
In the old set of data.
The old set of data. We see a flare once a day. In the prior decade, we have about a day and a half worth of data. And we see a thing that looks like a flare. Like it's just, you know that plot I showed of all the position angles, they all line up, okay? That's not true. One day is not the same. One day is not like the others. It's like Sesame Street, right? You get through life with Sesame Street. It's one of these things is not like the other, one of these things doesn't belong. And there's one day that's different, and if you look closely at that day, you can fit it with one of the flares,
and there were
fluctuations that were considerably larger in the millimeter light curves.
But were there optical X-ray observations on that day?
Which is really annoying. Okay, so to begin to answer some of the questions, I think about how well we could back information out of these, which really gets Jack to the meat of your question: how well can we get useful information out? Paul has started the process of plugging in low-resolution movies. He's now moved from 4 frames to 10, so we're making progress. Producing simulated data from a dynamical event. There's no background accretion flow, so this is a highly idealized situation. But there are 4 frames taken from this movie and asking how well can we reconstruct things. There's a lot of parameters that go into this. 3 of them have to do with the black hole. 5 of them have to do with how we set up the spot. And 2 of them have to do with the global structure of the accretion flow, so how it's going to shear and fall inward. Okay, most of these are local. That's a really important thing. We don't have to reconstruct the entirety of the accretion flow here. We're reconstructing the local properties of a spot. So most of them are just a number. And so just focusing on a couple of these parameters, spin, initial spot position, and the radial velocity of the spot, okay, we can do this for a spot that's located initially at 7 gravitational radii. We can do this again at a spot that's located at 10 gravitational radii and compare and contrast the two. And here I've just plotted them on top of each other, or Paul plotted them on top of each other, and I've color-coded them. This is not a non-converged MCMC run. The red things are from one, the blue things are from the other. The first thing you notice is that, indeed, the initial positions are quite different. They're actually they're centered on the right locations. Okay, so already we can start to say, we'd be measuring something like the radial infall velocity. And in an ideal situation, even in the early days, with only 4 frames, we can measure things reasonably well. We can also compare the spin measurement that we get. That affects the lensing. This has to be the same, right? Kerr makes a strong, unyielding prediction for this. There's one spin parameter for the spacetime. That should be true no matter which spot we look at. So you can imagine building up an array of spin measurements measured by, in some sense, sheaths through the space-time determined by those rays or those photons that hit that radius, okay? And map out what the spin parameter of the space-time in the galactic center is, and it had better be fixed spin. Going beyond Kerr, that's next. So there's a lot left to do, including introducing additional astrophysical knobs, see how much worse they make things. So just in conclusion, the first horizon resolving black hole images are imminent. Okay, so that's really exciting for us. Hopefully it's exciting for you. Time scales at the moment, figure January. That's when we're scheduled to stop arguing about them. We'll see how that works. But at the moment, I think we have many different potential handles on space-time structures, okay? So many different ways of getting at whether or not Kerr really describes space-time near the black hole. So we have some, you know, generic handles or apparent thing, generic handles like tests for horizons. I think we've tested whether or not there are apparent horizons. We can argue about what we have to do to get to event horizons. I'm not willing to spend an infinite amount of time arguing about it. Photon rings. Okay, it's a purely gravitational feature. Astrophysical modeling, if we believe the modeling, we could get to sub-percent precisions, but those are precisions, they're not accuracies until I convince you we should believe the modeling, but we're getting to the point where we're assessing the error budget, and it doesn't look so bad. And then there's a whole slew of forms of variability. I just talked about flares, and I mentioned briefly polarization, but there's also turbulence, there's also precession. Okay, so we see no evidence for a wobbling disk. So there was a question about inclination angle. Well, we tried to measure that, but there's also the question of inclination relative to the spin. It looks like it can't be terribly inclined relative to the spin. Otherwise, we should have seen precession over the decade, and we don't. We can look for...
This is for a thick disk, and a thin disk is different, though, right?
Yeah. Yes and no. So for a cool, thin disk, like a Novikov-Thorne disk, it's different. Yeah. Or a crushed disk, it's not.
Okay.
The crushed disk should be aligned no matter what.
Okay.
Brownian motion or the jitter motion associated from the nuclear star cluster, other times, et cetera. So there's a bunch of other forms of variability we can go after. And the thing that I want to end on is that one of the things we've been doing at the EHT initiative is building an extensible, flexible analysis tool or framework that allows us to incorporate not just the variety of EHT data types, which I mentioned before, but also all the ancillary information we have, like light curves across a variety of different wavelengths, information, prior information about masses and distances, and anything else you can imagine, and bring that all together and to bear on any physical model that we have and do so in a way that makes it easy to add additional space times, additional astrophysical models. And so, at this point, now I'm going to make my ask. Tell me what I'm supposed to put in there, and if we can start figuring out whether or not we'd say something about clouds of massive bosons. Thank you.
So for polarization, how well can you measure it, and where is the source of the polarized light?
Okay, so this
relative to the E score.
Oh, okay. Let's just jump back to the polarization picture. Okay, so how well can we measure it? You know, a few percent polarization fractions.
Few percent,
easily. I'm not sure if we know all of the calibration to get it a whole lot better than that.
If I told it look. Awesome.
I said we could measure with the precisions of a few percent. You can kind of see the colors here. This is less than 10%. Okay, these go up to 80%.
Yeah.
Okay, so on large scales, when we're averaging effectively over the entire picture, uh-huh. You get very little. But on the small scales, up to 80%. Okay, so a few percent if it's 80% polarized is pretty good.
Okay,
and it's all coming from synchrotron emission in the disk.
Does it help if the polarization is time varying? So let's say that there's another characteristic frequency, and it's not just the constant polarization, let's say that it has some periodicity.
Yeah.
Help with the precision?
Oh, if we can...
Let's say that the polarization, the vectors are going like this periodically.
Well, they are. Periodically.
Very periodically. Yeah. Not just change over time, some variability, but periodically.
And any periodic signal is easier to see. Yes.
By how much?
That depends upon the period.
Okay.
I mean, because essentially what you're saying is, can you stack data?
Yeah, we can
stack data. Effectively, a lot of what we're doing is stacking data according to the model. So if you give us a model for how it should vary, we can do that.
Yeah, because if the source of emission is very close to, if it's inside, for example, a super radiant cloud and it's an axion, then that there should be time-dependent variability of the signal because the field is oscillating. Mm-hmm. Now, generically, that should be around one part per thousand or less, right?
I think that's gonna, that might be a little bit difficult.
Okay. Because if it's an axion, you couple to the spin, to the...
Oh, you're trying to get axion photon?
Yeah, axion photon coupling.
Right.
Yeah. This is why I'm talking about that.
You also modify the metric.
Yes, of course. But I'm talking about...
Yeah, sure.
So one...
So even with stacking,
And what you want is not a modulation of the polarization amplitude.
Please.
You want a modulation of
the
direction.
Polarization axis, yes, not the amplitude.
So you can see the... Each one of these, so each point is at a given spatial frequency. So this is the Hawaii Karma, now defunct Karma baseline.
Yeah.
So two stations, and that's one observation. That's another observation a little bit later in the night. Another observation. Okay, the tick directions are telling us the polarization vector, the EVPA, electric vector polarization position angle. The color shows the magnitude. So you can see that it's moving through the night, but the question of how well we can orient that's a lot more dodgy. Because at least especially now, because ALMA has linear feeds, and if there is a slight, and they always crosstalk. So if there's a slight miscalibration in the gains, or a fluctuation in the gain miscalibration, which there certainly can be throughout the night, that will look like waggling polarization. So we don't actually, I think polarization direction is kind of hard here.
Okay.
We could imagine trying to do something where we measure the polarization shift relative to another baseline. I'm not sure if that will work. We could think about it. There might be ways to do it where we construct. If we just want to see changes between changes in time, maybe there are things that we can cook up. But at least for the things we made for now, polarization angle is a bit different.
Yeah, this would be changing the period of the crossing time. So it should be at around, let's say, a minute period.
The orbital time scales are, 5 to 30 minutes, depending on spin. So I guess you assume it's relatively, I guess it's modestly spinning in your case at best. So. Say 20 minutes.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, it depends on what they.
Yeah. Well, let's think about it. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can do something.
So, Avery, how muddy is M87 compared to Sagittarius Star in terms of, modeling the emission from the source? Because I guess you have the jet at large scales. I don't know if it complicates at small scales.
So we have that picture I showed you from the beginning was a model of M87. In fact, this is a model of M87's jet that's going off in that direction. In M87, it's hard to imagine that you see the disk at all. It has almost perfectly a broken power loss spectrum. And so we know the jets transitioning from optically thick to optically thin. And there isn't a lot of room. There's no bump or anything. There's not a lot of room to add another component. It's also easy to believe that the disk is completely invisible in comparison to the jet for a number of reasons, not the least of which is the core dominance of M87 is pretty weak. So. If you were to add another bright component in the center, typically it will make the core much brighter than the extended emission. That's just not seen. And if you try to conspire to make it comparable, then you add an additional component. If you took Sagittarius Star's disk, you just dialed up the parameters to M87, dialed up the mass to M87's mass, and you plunked it in M87, it would be far dimmer than the jet emission we see. So this is just a jet model, and it actually fits the M87 observations, which we have reported M87 observations very well, all by itself. But I'll tell you more in January. I don't know. I'm really excited to find out. I mean, that's a really important point. Is one of the astrophysical things we're going to do is we're going to look at Sagittarius Star, which has no obvious jet. We're going to look at M87, which has a prominent jet, and we can begin to ask the question of what's different. Yeah. So we'll see. So we have models that work really well. Are they complete? I don't know.
Okay. Well, let's thank Avery again.